This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Cheryl Eek. Today, we're looking at what's going to happen after the movement control order ends, whether it's on the 14th of April as planned or whether the government plans to extend it. The big question will be, what next? Do the lives of Malaysians go back to normal in terms of our work, studies, our businesses and entertainment, or will COVID-19 be around for the foreseeable future and forcing us into a new way of leading our personal and social lives? All of this I'm going to be discussing with Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal, epidemiologist from University of Malaya, who will hopefully provide some possible post-MCO scenarios for us. And if we're looking at the daily number of cases, those who test positive as well as those in ICU and the number of deaths, what would you say has been the impact of the movement control orders so far?
So I think overall, if you look at the number of cases reported, daily reported, right? It appears to be about between 100 and 200. Now, there is a reason for that, and I will go into that later. But I think overall, MCO has had its intended impact. Now, even with the MCO, we have to see the implementation of the MCO. So the MCO started, I think, about 3 weeks ago. And in the first week, the population took some time because of the sudden announcement of the MCO. A lot of people were taken aback, and it took the public, it took each one of us some time to actually figure out what we can and cannot do and what we should be doing. Yep. So what I saw was a sudden announcement, but following that sudden announcement, I think the government did the government got its act together with messaging and started coming out with good messages to the public. So not only telling them to stay at home, but telling them why they should stay at home. Now, in order to look at the impact of the MCO, we also have to understand a little bit about the dynamics of the disease transmission. And I think when we understand the disease transmission better, we will be able to appreciate what the MCO can do and what the MCO is not doing, right?
Yep.
So if we go back a little bit into the disease transmission, so Malaysia initially had this cluster of imported cases, right? Very few sporadic cases here and there. And then we had a single large area exposure, the Sri Petaling exposure, right? And that had spawned a generation, multiple generations of cases for those who were exposed and also those who went back and propagated it in the communities. So the MCO was introduced, I think, at a critical period to address those issues. That means we had an exponential increase in reported cases. It was looking alarming. It was looking like we were going to suddenly overwhelm our healthcare facilities. But at the same time, at that time, the amount of community transmission was low. That means other than the effect of the single area, we were not detecting any other community transmission. That means the transmission of disease in the wild. We say it in the wild, that means it means in the population or in the community. Mm-hmm. What the MCO has done is, the MCO has given the government the required enforcement activities to track down all those who were involved with that single area exposure. It also allowed the government to enforce forced physical distancing, so the social distancing. So in doing so, it prevented further propagation of any outbreaks. Now, typically, if you look at what has been reported by even my Ministry of Health and the Health DG, is that when there were occasions when there's large gatherings of people, the possibility of further propagation is high. The risk of propagating COVID is high because of its infectious nature. So if you're coming to MCO, I think it has done its work. It has done a lot of benefit in reducing the transmission dynamics. But the amount of time is not sufficient for total suppression, total containment. And I think that's a very big issue. Because if you were to ask what is an appropriate period, right,
yep,
for for an MCO or for a lockdown, whereby we can see the disease extinguish itself. To do that, we need not only isolate people, that means we need not make people stay in their house, but we have to have a very active case detection strategy. Mm-hmm. That means we have to detect all the possible cases that arise in the community, and we have to isolate those cases. So towards that part, the MCO has not addressed it that way. So the idea of MCO is just restriction of movement and seeking of care. But we are not actively going out and searching for those who have COVID-19. And I'm sure like a lot of the public has learned in the recent weeks that COVID-19, that there is a large group of individuals who are either asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic but can be infectious. That means they show no signs and symptoms of the disease. They don't have that cough, they don't have the fever, but they are already infectious. That means their droplets are infectious. Mm-hmm. The disease is still droplet-based. And so that is an issue. That's a very big issue. Because we don't isolate the cases in the community, that means we need a longer duration of total MCO if we wanted to actually contain this disease. Now, each public health measure has its advantages, but it also has its own disadvantages. So one big issue with the MCO is it has affected the economy. It has affected people's incomes. And more so in vulnerable populations, we are anticipating that there's disproportionate harm of total MCO to the vulnerable populations.
You mentioned earlier, in order for the disease to extinguish itself, is that actually a possible outcome?
So, extinguishing the disease from Malaysia is a possible outcome if we all stay at home, if we are all tested, if we are repeatedly tested, and all those who are identified as having disease get isolated. So it's a big if with many, many caveats in there.
And when you say if we are all tested, you mean mass testing then, not just people who may have symptoms or the risk factors?
Yes. So if you look at our testing strategy initially was very specific, right?
Yes.
It involved travel to Wuhan. Then it became international travel. But I think we're moving to the stage of testing where we have our testing capacity has improved tremendously, but we still don't have enough testing capacity for population-based or community-based testing. That's a very big issue.
In fact, if we were to look at the number of new cases that are being reported every day during this MCO period, as you've said, it ranges between 100 plus to 200 plus every day. But we also have more than 8,000 tests still pending results. How do we factor that in?
Yeah. So if you take the 8,000, so assuming that we have 8,000 samples which are untested, right? Let's just use some assumptions. Let's say 80% of the samples are from new cases, right? So that leaves us with 6,400. And let's say even 10% of the 6,400 test positive, that's about a pending 640 new cases, which have been sampled but have not been tested, but will add up to our total numbers. But this is all assumptions, mind you. Now, the more important question is, I find that our testing is still very specific, and it is a result of our limited testing capacity. Though Ministry of Health has increased its testing capacity and plans to increase it further to about 4,000 tests per day, but I think in order to totally contain the community transmission, we would need a lot more testing capacity.
Mm. And when we talk about testing capacity, what's our shortfall here? Is it resources to purchase the test kits, or is it laboratories to run the tests?
So let's stick with the standard test that's done. So number one is we're using real-time PCR tests, and this test does consume more time in its proper labs. We don't have a point-of-care rapid diagnostics yet. That's one issue to discuss later. But coming back to PCR, I think the kits itself, the issue with the number of kits we have That means how many test kits we actually have, and also the number of labs we have. And if you look over the past weeks, there have been attempts to increase the lab networks, and they have successfully increased the lab networks. But the point is, we should be doing more, I think. And the idea here is, at the moment, based on whatever I've analyzed, I think community transmission is still low. And thank God for that. Community transmission is still low, and we seem to have it under control at this point of time, in this week.
Okay, we'll get back to this after the break. My concern is community transmission is low because we've been able to contain the clusters and we've been able to keep everybody at home, but there's going to become a point where things have to go back to normal. So then would we see a spike then? And also when we come back from the break, we'll address the point of care rapid diagnostic tests. I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal, epidemiologist from University of Malaya, to try and understand what would happen if and when the movement control order is lifted. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyi. Joining me on the line is Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal, epidemiologist from University of Malaya. And we're asking, should things go back to normal after the MCO? What kind of data are we looking at now to determine whether the MCO is having its desired impact on flattening the curve? And what sort of medium to long-term measures do we need to look at to properly contain, perhaps even extinguish COVID-19 from our community? Before the break, Prof. Sanjay, you brought up point of care rapid diagnostic tests. So we were talking about our testing capacity, and right now we're using real-time PCR tests, which does take a while to analyze.
Yes, it does. So the issue actually is with rapid diagnostics that there has not been any tests which has sufficiently good results based on large samples and everyday samples to be recommended for testing. So the issue is not that we don't want to use a rapid diagnostics, but I think we may not have one which is accurate enough for use in the community. And there's always this issue that if you use a rapid diagnostic test which without good diagnostic accuracy, you may actually be giving false hope of feeling of where a person feels that they are not infectious, they're not infected, but actually they are. And then they go along in the community and they propagate the disease. What I would like to see is the introduction of rapid diagnostic tests, but we have to acknowledge that maybe a lot more research needs to be done in this area. I know it's that they are doing research internationally, but maybe more effort should be put in.
What other data are you looking at in order to analyze, or rather in order to predict what would be the disease trend moving forward?
To predict disease trends in the future, right? Typically, we use disease modeling techniques. Mm-hmm. So the one established model is the SIER model, whereby what we do is we estimate the number of the amount of population that are susceptible to a disease, mm-hmm. right? Then who among this population get exposed, and among those exposed, who gets infected, and ultimately among those who are infected, how many get cured or how many die? Now, what this does is, as more people get infected, this compartmentalized disease model is important, because with time, as more and more people get infected and recover, we assume that they are no more vulnerable to the strain anymore, that they gain this immunity. Mm-hmm. It is an assumption, but it's a common assumption for many diseases. Now, coming back to the MCO, so the issue with the MCO is, if the MCO is lifted, MCO is a direction, right? We should look at the purpose of the MCO rather than the MCO itself. So the purpose of the MCO is actually to enforce physical distancing, right? So that was the purpose of the MCO, number one. And number two, when there was a sudden spike of diseases, you wanted to have an immediate impact on the disease growth rate, the disease rate, right? Incidence rate, in order for the healthcare facilities to prepare and to be able to handle those patients. Now, as I said before, that 80%, 80-85% of those who get COVID-19 most likely will only have mild signs and symptoms and may not require hospitalization. You might have, if depending on the strategy used, you might either have to isolate them in isolation centers, or in some countries, they're using self-isolation where they go back home and they practice good hand hygiene, they practice appropriate PPE, personal protection equipment, like wearing masks at home, so on and so forth. Now, if you follow that line of thought, right, so the MCO was here to enforce physical distancing. Can we do that without regulation? So with the MCO, there has been a four-week period, and I think this period was important for a number of reasons. It was important for the public, for us to learn that we can actually work from home. We can actually live in our individual houses, apartments, so on and so forth. And we need not congregate in common areas. So that's one positive thing that it did. The second thing that the MCO did was, the MCO, I think, was a very good preparedness case scenario for the government, that in the future, if the cases spike to a point where there needs to be sudden enforcement or sudden activities have to escalate to handle large increases in the disease, the government has got that down in place right now. Mm. I think it took them some time, but it was an appropriate time because the daily number of cases were still manageable. Everything is manageable, and there's no mass fear and there's no mass panic. So in the future, let's say we move along the line that the MCO stops, and it's stopping not because it's not impacting the disease, but we also have to think about the quality of life of our population. People actually have to go to work, and the economy has to somewhat resume. Right? If we move along that line, then the MCO basically gave us an opportunity to learn to physically distance ourselves, and it gave the opportunity to government to prepare for future MCOs. So rather than one prolonged MCO, right, we also have to think about food security. So one thing that I always think about when we talk about the duration of MCO is food security. So I'm sure you've heard that there's hoarding of supply. Food of PPE at a global scale. So at the same time, our agricultural industry has to move. We have to produce food for ourselves. Because of the issue of food security, I think it'd be very difficult to have a complete MCO for long periods of time. Mm. And we need a very strong government for that. If the government prolongs the MCO, I think they're very brave. And they're doing the right thing to contain the disease, but we never know about indirect effects of this measure.
Could we potentially see a scenario of perhaps the MCO being lifted, and like you said, if a spike occurs and then another round of perhaps a shorter or perhaps a limited MCO within areas that are hot zones, could that possibly play out?
Yeah, you bring up very interesting possibilities. So at the moment, we're using the MCO as one solution fit all, right? That means we're doing this as a nationwide exercise. But you could look at it as localized exercise. And I think they have tried doing this in a few apartments and a few villages recently. And when you try to have localized MCOs, rather than localized MCOs, like localized enforced quarantines, it actually helps break the transmission where it's happening the most. Now, there are also some issues. The advantage of that is, number one, it's targeted. It's targeted to a community. It's targeted to a residential area. It's targeted to an apartment. So the effect is not widespread. For the rest of the 90% of the population, they can go on working. But the issue also crops up is, what happens to the people living in these areas which have been identified as for further quarantine of, let's say, 2 weeks, so on and so forth. So that's one scenario where we have targeted localized quarantines, mm-hmm. right? And the second scenario is where we may be using the MCO as a braking mechanism whenever it is felt that the disease transmission is happening rapidly. And to me, that we would be able to gauge that on a community-wide. That means if we have high level of community transmission and we need a single effective response, then the MCO comes back again.
Okay. And also you mentioned that the MCO, I mean, the idea of it was to enforce physical distancing by regulating it. And if there comes a point where the regulatory aspect is removed, do you think people can change their own behaviors to continue those kinds of distancing? You know, we were so concerned about mass gatherings like the Ramadan bazaars, you know, other activities that bring people back together in close confines again.
I think leaving it to a person to change their behavior is difficult. What we have to do is we have to facilitate the change in behavior by changing the environment. Mm-hmm. We have to look at this as an opportunity to innovate and change. And you mentioned the Ramadan Bazaar, for example, right? So Ramadan Bazaar, traditionally, we would be walking around, like in a bazaar, moving from stall to stall. It would be crowded with mm-hmm. people. And that is not something we would want right now. So the question is, how can we change Ramadan Bazaar to something that's conducive for physical distancing? And I've heard of a number of options put forward. So one is to have a drive-through Ramadan Bazaar, for example. May not be easy, but it's something different whereby you sit in your car, right, and you drive through, rather than this bazaar being about, let's say, 100 meters long, it can be 1 kilometer long with stalls faced out for a fixed certain distance, which will be conducive for, number one, interaction between the person in the car and the stall, and number two, it facilitates the purchase of things at this bazaar. So the idea is not that we should not expect people to change by themselves. We should facilitate the change by changing our environment. And that's something very fundamental. And going back to even going out for a movie.
Yeah.
So previously, when you go out for a movie, you're going with your friends or you're going with your family and you want to sit together. Well, guess what? It's not going to happen in the coming months or in the coming many, many months. So we have to change the way we behave. But more so, we have to change our practices. I think we have to change the environment. And it's everything. It's work. It's commuting, for example. So we do know that our commuting infrastructure is, for lack of a better word, stressed. There's a lot of people using our public transportation. But there has to be something done. And we may also have to think very seriously about staggered work timings.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than taking this concept that everybody goes to work at between 7 and 9 o'clock, we may have to look at working at all times of days and even staggering the industries. Yeah.
But along with that also, schooling, that's another consideration as well.
Yeah. Schooling is interesting because the issue with schooling is that there's a lot of students in a localized area. And I think the moment schools open up fully, whenever there is a case, the case will spread very fast, put it that way. And I think that they really have to explore the use of online learning in addition to going to schools. That means rather than, let's say, I'm sure the Ministry of Education is thinking about this, but rather than, let's say, going to school every day, going to school every other day, and that means Monday, Wednesday, and Friday you go to school, whereas Thursdays and Fridays you do online learning, or 1 week on, 1 week off. A hybrid of the solutions. But the issue with schools is, from the evidence that we have in literature, the disease is not that severe in children.
Mm-hmm.
However, children who stays with their elderly parents or elderly grandparents There's always this fear that the disease will spread in the schools and the children will bring it back to their families.
And such drastic change in practices, I mean, it's also about infrastructure, and is everyone able to access online education, for instance?
That is very true. And that's why I think education is, especially for primary and secondary, it's a bit more difficult, whereby I think the ministry may need more time to figure out how to change and what to do in the long term. So this is something very drastic. And as you said, not our population has, there is a disparity in access to, for example, high bandwidth, right? Mm-hmm. And there are some communities out there with less access, which may get affected disproportionately.
That's right. And one other thing when it comes to behavior change, if you could help us to sort of sort through the inconsistent information now about wearing mask versus not wearing mask, and especially moving forward as a routine measure now.
Yeah. So one thing about mask wearing, and even my message has changed, but that's because the disease has evolved, right? So when COVID-19 first came, right, we did not want mask hoarding. So the policies that came up from WHO, the policies that came up from the government, were consistent, as in it rationalized and prioritized the usage of masks. So the frontliners or the healthcare workers should use masks. People who are symptomatic should use masks. And the rest of us, we should save the mask. Rather than buying and using masks, we should save this mask for those important frontliners, be it patients or be it healthcare workers. Now, the complexity arises when you have community transmission, number one. And number two, when there is this pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic stage where a person not wearing a mask may be infectious to others. But ultimately, the decision, right? So it's a very fine balancing act, but I think it depends on the availability of masks. So if we are at a time now where we have enough masks, then it'd be good for people, the usage of mask, just so that you don't infect others. Again, it depends on the availability of the mask. So I'm talking about surgical 3-ply mask, right? The usage of cloth mask and the usage of other types of mask, I think are just desperate efforts to seek protection when there is lack of a 3-ply surgical mask. Now, I think we should remember that when a person wears a mask, the person is actually protecting the people around them rather than protecting themselves. So the disease is droplet-based. So typically in patients, we ask patients who are symptomatic previously, and now a lot of hospitals are going towards where all patients get a mask, is the idea that the patients themselves don't spread the disease knowingly or unknowingly to others. And I think that's, I've seen a lot of circulars come out by local municipalities, local governments, stating that people should wear masks. But I think it's difficult to enforce. It should still be a recommendation rather than enforce. So I've heard of places where if you don't have a mask, the shopping complex doesn't allow you in. I think that's difficult because we should acknowledge that, number one, mask is not cheap, and number two, that we still may, certain populations, right, certain parts of the populations still don't have access to a surgical 3-ply mask.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to mask, right, I'd like to be specific here. What I think is all patients in hospitals, when you go to a hospital, they should be wearing a mask. And in a healthcare facility, mask use should be compulsory, right? But in everyday life, it depends on the level of transmission. See, wearing a mask, it does give you a benefit. But the issue with the benefit is very, very, very small. So the number of masks that we all need to wear in real life in order to achieve a significant benefit is a lot. That means we would have to consume a lot of masks in real life, in just normal life. Mm. And there's the mask, it's not just wearing a mask, but there's mask etiquette to it.
Mm.
Like, if you wear a mask and you soil it, then you're supposed to to dispose of it appropriately. And if you, let's say you wear a mask, and this is something I commonly see everywhere, when you wear a mask and people start talking, they pull down the mask.
And they leave it hanging. Talk. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, then they leave it hanging. Then when they eat, they pull it up, so on and so forth, and they're touching everything. Again, then the fingers are your agents. And that's why hand hygiene, rather than concentrating on wearing masks, I would say if you're symptomatic, whatever symptom, right? If you're feeling unwell, wear a mask. But number two, you have to practice good hand hygiene. And hand hygiene need not buy an expensive sanitizer for your hand to practice good hand hygiene. But it's as simple as washing your hands with soap and water for about 20 seconds. And repeatedly washing as you're moving around. And if let's say you're outside and you go to supermarket, one thing we seem to have forgotten is bleach and water works wonders, right? So you don't need a lot of these expensive sanitizing liquids. So good hand hygiene, if you want, you can carry a bottle of bleach and water. That should protect you somewhat.
Well, the bleach and water is for surface wiping on surfaces. Prof. Sanjay, let's wrap up by coming back to the issue of, well, what next? Assuming that the MCO ends on the 14th of April, or even if it is extended, what should we expect to happen after that? And how should we prepare ourselves?
So, number one, with regards to an MCO, if you wanted an MCO to successfully eradicate the disease, I think we need a further month or so. So I don't think that is feasible. But I think what we should expect is a new normal where as we move back to as the MCO ceases, that all of us have to basically practice physical distancing everywhere. Life will not resume like it was in December or November. This year is going to be very interesting. We are in it for the long haul. I think that is something that we should be prepared for. We should hope for the best, but at the same time, we should prepare for the worst. So as the MCO, if the MCO ceases, right, and we are allowed to go back to normal life, I think it's very, very important for companies and people to have a continuity plan. For companies, a business continuity plan, planning for future and forced physical distancing, and for people. That means for all of us to learn new skill sets that we will need in the coming months. So I'm sure many of us previously had not heard of Zoom, for example, right? Well, many people are not involved with teleconferencing, but now all meetings are happening over this.
Yes.
So one thing that we should do is in the coming months, in the coming weeks or months, we should gain appropriate skill sets that will prepare us better for the future.
When you say long haul, I'm just curious, how long are we talking? Are we talking a year or more?
Realistically speaking, until one of two things happens. Number one, a vaccine is developed. Now, the typical timelines with vaccine development, I don't know, it varies from a year plus to many years. But I got a feeling with the complexity of COVID-19 and the magnitude of effect that's having on the population, we may see a vaccine being released much sooner. So we will have to continue physical distancing until, number one, either a vaccine is released, or number two, we achieve herd immunity. That means a significant proportion of us get the disease and we recover and we protect the remaining susceptible populations. How long it takes? Anyway, I would say plan for the rest of the year. Hope for the best. So we can always live in hope. So my hope is by June. Mm-hmm. But I would prepare for at least until the end of the year.
And you're right. Everything we know about COVID seems to be changing so rapidly. And there's no way to really tell what we say today holds true tomorrow.
Very true. It's a very, very dynamic internet. I find it fascinating that we get so much information. So much information is coming out about this disease. But I think that's just because of the scale of the disease. And as you see, some countries are getting hit very much more worse. And I think we have been lucky so far.
Mm. Thank you so much, Professor Sanjay. I've been speaking to Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal, epidemiologist from University of Malaya, about what happens after the movement control order ends. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.